Hello and welcome to Series 3 of Tell Dem, a podcast hosted by The Masher in partnership with Transmission Roundhouse, generously funded by the Paul Hamlin Foundation.
This series, we're shifting things around a bit, bringing you bold and unfiltered discussions around decolonising theatre.
Every episode, we'll be joined by amazing theatre makers from the global majority, discussing power structures, global influences,
what they do, how they do it, why they do it.
We're your hosts, Gidiga
and Beth,
and you are tuning into episode number 5. This podcast contains themes that listeners may find disturbing, triggering, or uncomfortable. Reach out to me. Thanks for tuning in to episode 5, series 3 of Tell Dem. You can join us today with some really gorgeous discussions by
Mojisola Adebeo and Millie Bhatia. So we start with a conversation about inspiration, which we go really, really far into talking about where people find inspiration and then how that fuels their creative process and how they make work off of that, which I think is just such a great insight.
Absolutely. And we started to really talk about Millie's experience, especially working within a literary department. And also Mojisola joined the conversation about how they could be helpful and also a hindrance. So we talked a little bit about structures that do not serve us as global majority artists and how we can overcome them.
And finally, ending on some advice that they've received that they want to pass on. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in this room. So I think it's a really special episode and really excited to share it with you.
Welcome to Series 3, Episode 5 of Tell Dem. You are joined by your host, Githy Gabatu.
And me, Beth Capilla.
And today we are joined by some awesome guests. We've got an awesome lineup. Who have we got in the room, Beth?
So we have Mojisola Adebeo, who's zooming in from Berlin. Very exciting.
Very cool.
Very exciting. And we have Millie Bhatia here in the room with us today. Mm-hmm. So first up, we have Mojisola Adebeo, who is a playwright, performer, director, producer, mentor, and professor who has been making theatre for social change internationally for over 30 years, from Antarctica to Zimbabwe. And some of Mojisola's own plays include Moj of the Antarctic, an African Odyssey, which was at the Lyric Hammersmith, I Stand Corrected, which was with Artscape Cape Town, and Wind / Rush Generations at National Theatre Connections, and Stars, which was a co-production between Tamasha and the Institute of Contemporary Arts, which was developed on a residency with Idle Women and won the Off West End Award for Best New Play. Very exciting to have you with us, Mojisola.
So Millie is a theatre, film and radio director and dramaturg from East London. She's an associate artist at Synergy and was the associate director at the Royal Court until 2023. She's a two-time Olivier Award nominee, and her work has been nominated for Visionary Arts Award, Off West End Awards, and for the Asian Media Awards. And her work has both received West End and international transfers. As director, some of her credits include Seven Methods of Killing Kylie Jenner by Jasmine Lee Jones, Blue Mist by Mohammed Zain Dada, and Chasing Hares by Shonali Bhattacharya. Great.
Shall we ease on in with our first question that we ask everybody, which is, what inspired you this week or recently? Like, what has been inspiring you? Whoever wants to jump in and kick us off.
I can go first. I was saying before we started recording how much I've admired Mojisola for years, so it's so lovely to meet you. What's inspired me this week? I, over the weekend, went to an event by the White Kite Collective, which is a grassroots group of cultural workers united in support of the Palestinian people. I've been to a lot of their events and worked on some of them with them, but I've been consistently inspired by the resilience, hope and humour of Palestinian artists. And in this particular event, we heard from Hossam El Madoun, who is the co-director of Theatre for Everybody in Palestine. So that was definitely a highlight for me, and deeply inspiring. And then the second is quite personal. I lost my nanny mum, my mum's mum, last July. She and I were very close. And I've not until very recently, because it's coming up to a year of her death, looked at the things that she's left me. And one of the things that she left me was a handwritten cookbook. And not only does it have these extraordinary recipes in it, but they are also connected to stories about how her mother and grandmother would teach her to cook as a kid in their village in Punjab. And there's also hand-drawn maps of the village, which I'm sure doesn't look the same as it does now. So that I sort of realised I was holding a really important piece of legacy and history in my hands, and it's sort of an important reminder. I suppose that connects a lot to me, to seeing these extraordinary accounts of people that are in Gaza and sharing their stories with us, and how important it is to document our history. So those two things kind of sat in my mind hand in hand.
So beautiful. Mm. Have you cooked any of the recipes on there yet?
I have. Oh, do you know what? For fear of inferiority. It's like, you know, you can never cook as well as your nanny.
No,
I feel like
can.
That's a universally acknowledged thing for the Desi girls. It's just not yet. I'm not there yet.
Amazing. Roger Sola, could we go over to you? What's been inspiring you this week?
That was also inspiring, just hearing from Millie, actually. That's really beautiful. So much has inspired me. I think a common theme is youth, but I'm actually going to shout out to this incredible performance called Your Name is Dead. Your Name is Dead. And I can't say it in Welsh. But the title is in Welsh. It was by Algan Rees and Leo Drayton, a group of young people. I don't know exactly where in Wales they're from, but it's the very first time a piece of theatre has been staged at the National, apparently that isn't in the English language, which is just, well, first of all, it's just ridiculous. We have so many languages in our islands and so many. I mean, probably, I think all of the young people that performed in my play, Windrush Generations, every single one of them is bilingual. It was just totally inspirational, this piece, this performance. It was so beautiful. It was all about, it's kind of coming of age story, where a young person is basically approaching their day, where they're going to have a new name, and they're a trans young person. Wonderful to have a trans story, a queer story up there on stage at the National. Mm-hmm. But it was all the more moving somehow that these young people were speaking in their first language, which is so often a forgotten language outside of North Wales and West Wales. So yeah, it was just gorgeous. Just diversify language on stage as well. Yeah, it was really inspirational. Your Name is Dead.
Sounds gorgeous.
I can't believe that there's not been a play in another language at the National Theatre. That is, that is bonkers. And hopefully it will change soon. How about you, Gidka? What's inspired you this week?
Oh, God, I haven't really left the house, to be honest. It's been a bit wild. I've done that thing, you know, when you like work job after job and then you've not done any washing or cleaned your house. So I've just been in doing all of that. And then my mum told me to watch this thing on Netflix called Hiramandi, and I started it 2 days ago. Oh, my God.
Yes.
I'm obsessed. It's so good. I don't think it's gorgeous to look at. It's very extravagant. The British had got to India,
during British occupation, yeah.
Sure, and it like stretches quite a big time span because it goes back and then it comes forward and then it goes to future. But it's super empowering to watch as a woman and a brown woman, because I'm like, oh my God, these are my ancestors, man. They're fucking cool. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're dripping in gold. They're like, they're just queens walking around in these massive palaces and saying no to the British. And it's just, yeah, it's just really empowering to watch. But also, I'm here for the musical interludes and all that stuff. It's just one big, long Bollywood film in 6 episodes. It's incredible.
It's stylistically, it's done so well, isn't it? And the costume and the design. My mum made me watch it.
Yeah, it's so cool. And I heard that all of it is not fake. You know, all the jewellery, it's all proper gold, which I don't even want to think about that budget and where they got it from, but like, it's stunning. Mm-hmm. Check it out.
Yeah, well, now I'm like writing it down furiously.
Yeah, go for it. Loads of things to check out. What about you, Beth?
I've got a book called Wandering Souls by Cecile Pin, and I think it's their debut novel, which is amazing because it's like been nominated and shortlisted for so many awards. But it tells the story of a family who were part of the wave of refugees from Vietnam to kind of spread across the world, really. But this particular family came to the UK kind of by accident. It's quite a heartbreaking, harrowing story. What I'm finding really fascinating is directly from the perspective of the people who are making this epic journey, and you don't often hear that perspective. And also linking up to my own family, like my great aunt helped resettle Vietnamese boat people when they came to the UK, and so it's like linking that part of my own heritage up and just sort of like understanding what her job actually was. And yeah, it's been really inspiring.
Lovely. Millie's also writing that down.
Just stealing everyone's ideas. Thank you.
Amazing. So that's great to hear about everything that inspired you this week, and that actually leads really nicely onto our first question, which is about where you seek out inspiration. Where do you go to find it as an artist? And I'm going to do a thing where I just be quiet and then someone's going to say their piece.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about this. I think in a couple of ways. I think I read, watch and listen to as much as I can. And I think really other people's art is a great source of inspiration for me. And where I can, I'll absorb lots of different kinds of art, not just theatre. Like at the moment, I'm trolling my way through A24's back catalogue because I'm directing a horror in the autumn.
That's so cool.
But I also think that my greatest tool for inspiration is probably the conversations I can have with my fellow artists. I think I'm lucky to have this community of people around me that are such an amazing sounding board for dreaming big. You mentioned Mohamed Zain Dada. He and I are working on quite a few things together at the moment, but we will often just talk at each other to go, what do you think of this? Does this work? And encourage each other to kind of think big about ideas. And I think, you know, I have that conversation with a lot of fellow artists, collaborators. If we didn't live under capitalism, like you said about making with opulence, how big could we possibly think about how we could make this piece of work? Who would we love to reach with it, and how? And I think that is probably the most valuable tool I have for inspiration and imagination is talking to other artists.
Mm. Yeah, nice.
Mm. I guess there are different stages to a creative process, I suppose, like before you kind of get in the room, I suppose. Is that process of seeking inspiration different at those different stages of your creative process?
That's such a great question. I suppose... yes. I think the first thing I always want to do when I'm going to make something or conceiving something is not to think about limitation, and to go, what is this piece of work trying to do? And then the practical thinking will come later into it. But I want the idea, if I can hold on to that original seed of this is what the work is, what it wants to do, who it wants to platform, then that thinking shifts as more practical conversations come into play. But I think, yeah, as I said, sort of, I think our greatest tool under capitalism is imagination. And I think if we can kind of galvanise each other as artists to think really big about what we might be able to make, I think that seed we can always hold on to, even when we are told, you don't have that much money to make it. I think it does.
Yeah, I think that's also such an underutilized tool sometimes. I'm speaking from myself as well about like going to your mates and talking about stuff, but because I do that, but I also feel like all of us are tired. Do you know what I mean? Especially like artists and stuff. Sometimes the last thing I want to do is speak to people about other people's theatre. But then again, like, you might as well utilize creative brains around you and share practice. I think it's so useful. Marge, where do you look to?
I find it a difficult question, only in the sense of I think of inspiration as something kind of uplifting and something that makes you tingle and something that kind of lifts you up and makes you look up. I think for me, inspiration comes from maybe a different kind of inspiring, a different kind of breath. It connects with, I suppose, breathing in deeply and going to what's really in my gut and what I find extremely difficult, painful, anger-making, disturbing, things that torture me, keep me awake at night. And not necessarily that the product itself comes out as something really, really heavy. The inspiration for my work definitely comes from things I can't let go of, and questions that I'm kind of tormented by. So it's interesting that Millie was saying about working on a horror, and I'm very, very slowly working on a horror. And the inspiration has come from being so horrified at the racism and the things that I've experienced, and not just myself, of course, and going, why, when it's this bad, don't people think of white supremacy and whiteness as a social construct as horrific? Mm-hmm. Why is the horror of white supremacy thought of in Germany in terms of the past, not in terms of the present that still continues? So yeah, inspiration comes from frustrations like that, fear, anger, not pretty stuff. But then the good feeling starts, because then I go, right, I've got to read everything. I've got to watch everything. I've got to listen to every piece of music that's ever been made about this. And that, you know, that's when the joy begins.
That really resonates with me. And I love, not to summarize all those brilliant things that you just said into one sentence, but that I really resonate with the idea that being inspired isn't always comfortable.
And I
think that relates actually to some of the things I was saying have inspired me, certainly around acts of solidarity for Palestinians and accounts of Palestinians that is not comfortable, but it rouses to action. And I think, yeah, being uncomfortable is absolutely part of that process. Being inspired by activists, and I think, again, this is not necessarily, organising is not always comfortable work, but actually it sort of made me think about how important that relationship is with my work, and if we can ask the same questions of that as well as our work, in that resistance, responsibility and solidarity, if we can ask how our art does that as well as our organizing, that is not comfortable, but it's necessary.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about the horror.
Yeah. Can you talk about that?
It's by a very dear friend and collaborator of mine, brilliant playwright, Shonali Bhattacharya, who you mentioned earlier. And she's written a play called King Troll, The Fawn, which is going to be at New Diorama in the autumn. And I can't talk about the cast or the team. They're amazing. watch out for them. But it's a horror about the hostile environment. And it follows the story of two migrant sisters and their navigation of the horror of the Home Office. Okay. She's really lent into that form and that stylistic language in the most thrilling way.
For both of you, I suppose, is there a point when you feel like, how are you seeking that form as you're like shaping that early idea, seeking inspiration? Does that come into that process? How am I going to share this idea?
Yeah, I think for me the how is one of the not an early question. The first question is for me is the what is the why, which usually leads me to a what if. So with Stars that we made with Tamasha last year, is coming back next year. It was around the why about orgasm, and why my body doesn't orgasm, and why millions of women's bodies don't orgasm. And then I start researching the Dogon of Mali, who've got this really interesting kind of ideas around the sexual body, but also space. And the closest I come to an orgasmic feeling is being on a dance floor with my friends, watch out. Why does this just have to be a play? Let's make the play transform into a club night. Because dance and music is just ecstatic and orgasmic. And I would also bet that a lot of people were like, would you rather have an orgasm or a really fantastic night out on the dance floor? I think lots of people take the second. It's not just me. but preferably both at the same time.
Yeah, preferably both.
So the form of that play very much came from, you know, the why, the what if, and then the research and then the how. It's also allowing myself to do the obvious. Sometimes we think, especially as writers and emerging writers, that you've kind of got to come up with a clever idea, and people get very, very invested in the how you do something. Whereas the how will almost always be a given from the content.
I love what you just said about a few questions ago. It just resonated massively about the reality being so horrifying, and that being a way into like understanding how best to communicate a story, but also what you just said about form and architecture of a piece of work sort of being informed by how it makes you feel, or you want people to feel, and engaging with it. And I, that is so beautiful. And that also speaks that really how I understand horror being the perfect form to talk about the Home Office. That is absolutely brilliant.
I can't wait for that one. I'm going to do a little segue, actually, because we're talking about the why being important and then the how just happens next. And actually, it links sort of to a question that we really wanted to ask you guys and get your opinion on about being supported by theatres, institutions. More and more we're seeing literary departments from theatres disappear. Is that a useful thing? Does that allow us to put the why first and the how to come afterwards? Or is it actually a bad thing, you know, that that support isn't necessarily there for writers? Is the support right in the first place, especially when we're speaking about global majority artists?
Yeah, I mean, I've got mixed feelings. I mean, number one, I think trustees, boards of directors, artistic directors, etc. Their, you know, number one responsibility is to keep people in their jobs, and not go sacking people, making people redundant, cutting things, and addressing structures of power that mean that you can have one person at the top that just fires loads of people overnight. Mm-hmm. You know, the power of the union, like the trade union, but just the idea of the union and the unity and the Ubuntu of the union, that together we look out for it. It makes me want to cry, actually, that we together we work, together we make things, and that there's, for me, no art form that is more about a union than theatre. I think it's, I know film people would be listening to this and go, what are you talking about? Musicians would be going, you know, but that's because for me, theatre is the art of being human, the art of humanity, and the art of all art forms. And I'm not saying it's the best or anything crap like that, but like, because theatre is the only art form for me that can include every art form. And so this preposterous idea that you have really hierarchical structures that lose people just at the click of a finger without going, look, our funding's been cut. How do we do this? Let's get together. Let's get together, spend some time together. Everybody bring food from home and figure out how everybody is going to be able to pay the rent, feed their family, do their thing. It makes me want to cry. So that's one big thing for me about, you know, about dramaturgs and literary departments, is if people are in their place of work, the number one aim should be to help sustain people in their place of work and develop them. And it doesn't mean that people should stay forever. There should also be structures that allow people to move on in supportive ways. This all should be massive mentoring so that theatre companies don't just reproduce old privileges and all that kind of stuff. But that's the trade unionist in me, is that's my kind of number one response to that. What do you think, Lily?
I mean, man, I wish I went first. How do you follow that? I mean, I completely agree with you, because what you talked about so succinctly was kind of the communal and collective action of making theatre and engaging with theatre. To go back to Githika's question about whether I think it's useful or a hindrance, is, I mean, I think the best literary departments and the way to engage with artists and writers of all kinds are to know. And full transparency, I worked in a literary department at the Royal Court for 2 years, and I think the best versions of that structure are ones that go, there is not one way to make a piece of theatre. We don't expect that a three draft and rehearsal draft structure is going to serve everyone. And I think the best versions of those processes are one that start with the artist and go, how do you make, what is your process, and how can I best support that and collaborate with you on that? But I think also why literary departments are so important is because they demystify. They're about access, and that's access for artists to get into buildings, but they're also about demystifying the process of how the fuck you get your play on.
Yeah.
It's becoming more difficult now than ever, and you see it in what's being programmed, that people are not engaging with new writing and new writers in the same way. That is devastating, and I think that is directly linked to the really important work that literary departments do to engage unsolicited scripts and writers they don't already have relationships with. Mm-hmm. And that is about access. And I think that's going to get worse without these departments. So I'm a hard advocate for literary departments. I think they do really important work.
And maybe just on the theme of demystifying, maybe for people who have little knowledge of what actually goes on in a literary department, would you mind maybe speaking a little bit about, like, how is it structured? Who works there? How do you engage with things like external readers? What's their purpose? All of these sorts of things. Because mm-hmm. I think, it's really useful just to demystify.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose I say they demystify in that they are a direct access point into the building, because lots of literary departments do or did read unsolicited scripts. So if you didn't have an in into that building and you wanted to engage, at the Royal Court, I can only speak specifically about my experience in the department as it was when I worked there.
Sure.
But there are many different structures. But we read every script. So we had pools of readers. One of the jobs I had as a literary associate in the couple of years I was in that department was managing that pool of readers, who were the most brilliant artists of all kinds across our industry, and would read scripts and write script reports for us. And based on their recommendations, one of the team would read the scripts, we'd meet the writer, or they'd get a report from a reader, or we'd meet them and engage with them, or we'd ask for another draft. So there were several ways of that relationship developing through that first stage. But they were all engaged with. Every script that was sent to us was engaged with. And you can imagine at the Royal Court,
that's incredible.
Thousands of scripts.
Because mm-hmm. It's also got a global reach, doesn't it, the Royal Court?
Yeah.
It doesn't just take submission, well, at least at that. I'm not actually sure what the structures are right now, but at least at that point it was taking scripts from around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and we had also an international department who would also work with writers internationally and ran lots of programmes abroad and with international writers here as well. So, I mean, it's the writers' theatre, it is. So that was always a focus. But I advocate for literary departments in all theatres. I think they are such an important access point into theatre's ecology and into the work, and an amazing way to meet new artists. And I think if you work in a theatre building, it is your responsibility to be actively seeking artists that you don't already know.
Absolutely.
And to be engaging with them and finding ways to engage them with the building.
Mm. Yeah.
And I suppose from your perspective, Marge, what is that relationship, or what do you see the role of a literary department is from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've got a really lovely relationship with Ola Amanashawan, who's a wonderful dramaturg and human being, currently at the National Theatre. And what's so special about that relationship is the support, is the acceptance, is someone who knows me very well, knows my style and knows my habits, some of them bad habits, knows my strengths, really gets that, for example, that I come from, you know, that I come from devising and performing, and I only ended up writing Modge of the Antarctic because I thought nobody's going to do this. Black woman cross-dresses as a white man and goes to Antarctica play with me. Nobody's going to call me up and ask me to devise that.
That's so brilliant.
so I'm going to have to do this one on my own. But I thought of the process as a devising process, because it's also set in the mid-19th century. So I just said to myself, you're devising, but you're devising with loads of dead people. You're devising with Karl Marx and Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, and you're devising with all of them. It's just that they don't happen to be physically around anymore. So just imagine that you're in a studio with them and let their words feed your, you know, as you would when you're performing. So I thought of myself as a deviser and a maker, and I still do. And, you know, someone like Ola really understands that. So when I say to Ola, I need to be in a room, I've written some stuff, but I don't know, I just need to be in a room with some people. He understands that that's writing. Mm-hmm. And this idea of what writing is, and it speaks to what Millie was saying about the different kinds of ways of making artwork. That's also that we're very stuck in Britain in this kind of very colonial construct of what writing is.
Yeah.
And that we are writing now, mm-hmm, by speaking with each other. We're writing our lives in every moment. We write through the body. We write collaboratively. We write alone. We write with a pen. We write with a phone. We write by speaking out loud. We write by singing. We write by dancing. Those things aren't not writing. And so I think I would take the literary out, because it makes the page dominate. And we're in the era of podcasts now. We're in an era of Instagram now. We're in an era of so many forms of communication, that if we hold the page too hard as the kind of ultimate, and we'll stay stuck in the past. And I love the page, you know, I love books and all of that. But I think I think that's what it is for me. I'll take the idea of the literary, because it has all sorts of exclusive connotations, and just thinking about writing as what we do constantly, and people do that in different kinds of forms.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree, and I feel like that's that true decolonial work of expanding the accepted forms, mm-hmm, of producing work. And I suppose what may be a challenge or something to think about is, how do we create a structure of, like, say, if we remove literary from the literary department, or how do we create a department that is able to accept other forms other than the written page for, like, first-time makers?
Yeah, I think Millie said it partly as well about listening to the artist and asking, you know, what's your process? What do you need? And if you don't know what your process is, what makes you feel good?
Yeah.
And what they like to play with, and just and also thinking about time. You know, that was a really good experience of that right attachment I had to the National Theatre. I said, it doesn't work for me to sit in a room for 6 weeks on my own. Can I have a year? And can I come in whenever I like? Mm. And do I have to sit there? And they said yes. You know, and we broke it, you know, broke the money down and worked all that kind of detail out. But really listening to the artist, I think, is what's really crucial.
I completely agree. And I think, to go back to what I said earlier about dream big without thinking about the reality of living under capitalism, I'm going to answer this question with that in mind, which is what Mojisola just articulated is about time, and about time to discover and time to play, and also the discovery of form within that. I directed a play in Sweden, and I had 2 months to make it. And if you know anything about how long you have to make it here, it's on in 4 weeks in front of an audience. And especially on a new play, you get quite dexterous at kind of going crunch, but it's extraordinary. And having even that 2 month period to just really discover what the play was, felt like such a luxury. In the same way that they didn't do tech rehearsals till 10 o'clock.
Mm.
So, you know, the well-being of the room was... Why does that feel so radical?
I know.
The well-being of the room was so much better, and the morale and the energy.
Mm.
So I think it's... If we had the ability to be more... And of course we can, it's just a question of how we do it. And to go back to Mojisola's point, let's talk about unions. But I think we do need to go, you know, what process serves us? If we are able to do that, what process best serves the piece of work I want to make? What process best serves this artist? How can I best enable that? And I think that's my job as a dramaturg, because I do work as a dramaturg separately from my directorial work. And my job is, first and foremost, not to enforce what I expect the play to be or piece of work to be, or what I think it should be, but rather really listen to the artist and both figure out how I can get them to what they want to make and also the best process to achieve that. Mm. So if we can apply that to the idea of removing the word literary in this context, but if we can apply that to the departments that are there for the support of artist development, yeah, that might enable a very different kind of process and different kind of form. Mm.
Yeah, that's so inspiring, and I hope younger artists who are listening really sort of like take that on and use it as a form of like a tool of empowerment, because I think so often those structures I was talking about can feel like you have to fit into them and, you know, wait for a micro commission call out to then shove your idea into their format. Here's 100 words to tell me what your idea is, and then already is your first restriction, your first artistic barrier. It's really empowering to listen to you both speak, and absolutely we should all be thinking like that no matter what stage of your career.
Mm. And sometimes it can be really hard to ask for what you want, but actually it sounds like, you know, the boxes are there just for their purposes, and we should be asking for what we need. And that,
I'm curious what you both think about literary departments.
Yeah, to be honest, I feel like, so living up north, regional theatres, I can only speak for the northwest because that's where I am, but around me there isn't really many. There's a dramaturg that's there and it's one person usually. There's also a lot of white women up north who are in those seats. So it's gorgeous to hear Millie, and again, so inspiring about how you guys were working at the Royal Court, because I would love something like that up north, even if it was just a pool of dramaturgs or a literary department or a department of people who are helping, you know, develop these ideas, who would like work across the region. That would be amazing. But sometimes it feels like if there is one dramaturg in a position of power, if you like, who is that gatekeeper between the artist and the artistic director or that stage or being put on, it can sometimes feel like a hindrance, because not all artists and dramaturgs think like you. Again, do what you guys were talking about, better serve the work for them and by them versus the theatre trying to condition it into something it needs to be put onto their main stage.
Yeah, absolutely. I love what you said there, Gitika, because I think I talked about unions and all that kind of thing, and protecting people's jobs. The other side of my feeling about it is that there's also, you know, too many people in jobs that are very hierarchical and where they won't ever leave or think about the next generation coming up or diversify at all. Like you said, a lot of white women in positions of power, not just white men, of course, but especially in the realm of dramaturgy. So I do feel conflicted about that. And, you know, and I suppose, you know, the structures need to change also within those kinds of departments and that kind of thing. And I love what you're saying as well about young people, and you know, I feel like sometimes we're really stuck in Britain in the idea of that's just the way things are, that certain things are the way things are, and that's number one stage oppression, because in any situation where we are oppressed, what happens to us is we get closed down and we think that is just the way it is and I can't do anything about it. And Britain is so hierarchical and so problematic that we've just got used to so much shit. We've just got used to it. And thinking, well, the only way I will ever get a play on is if I have to convince this white woman sitting in a regional theatre in X City that my play about my queer Pakistani, Danish, Nigerian, German family, that's just me, is ever going to go on. I have to, you know, get that person to say yes, and I have to write in that form. You know, it's just too much, and then I might get a grand, you know, to kind of develop my idea. It's like we have to say, okay, one, we've got to dismantle those structures. And two, fuck the structures and do it anyway. The first theatre company I made with my friends, we didn't have any rehearsal rooms, so we just We just used to hide at Goldsmiths, just finding rooms. And we didn't find a room for free, that is. Goldsmiths College, that is. We'd just rehearse in whoever had the biggest bedroom. So it was the guy I was seeing at the time. Outrageous. Modric's not always been a lesbian. And the guy I was seeing at the time, he had the biggest bedroom. So we rehearsed in there. And the premiere was that we invited our friends and people to come to the living, to his bedroom and see the play and give us feedback. That's how I started. We just did it ourselves with Oranges and Stones, which used to be called 48 Minutes for Palestine. We made that show that's just come to Britain by the time we broadcast. It's with zero money, absolutely no money. Nothing. I literally we didn't have a designer. We didn't have all of those things. I bought a bag of oranges for the equivalent of about 50p because I thought we've got to create a space. How do we create a space in Palestine? How do we make a theatre space? So I thought, I just went outside in Ramallah and went, oh, there's loads of rocks. There's loads of stones. So I'll get loads of stones and I'll buy some oranges. And we'll make a circle with oranges and stones. And that's the title. And it's also created the playing space. It's all created the design. And it also made the story, because the oranges and the stones become part of the story, made with nothing. And now it's toured, you know, four continents, and it's still going after 14 years. So if I'd waited for a dramaturg sitting in a literary department to tell me that this was good enough, we would never have made that piece of work. Mm-hmm. It would just never happen. So it's like, go for the seed commissions, go for all of that. And also, if they say no, just do it in your front room or do it on the street.
Yeah, I think that's...
I love that.
I could go on, so I'm just going to keep it brief. I think we do need to radically reimagine literary departments and... But just like one tiny thing, if any artistic director or literary person is listening, I think that we need to allow space for readers to go, I'm not the right person to be reading this and assessing whether this piece is of value, because you might just not, it might just not have reached the right person. And I've had that, I've experienced that. I've read for the Royal Court, I've read for the sort of awards and things, and I think that that's been sort of a really empowering thing, is just like going, right, I'm not the right person to assess this. Also, I think there should be more training for people reading scripts to sort of understand that there's more than one culture and approach to theatre making. So I think that's also something that... Yeah.
So we're going to have to come on to our last question, which is, it's about advice, actually. So looking back on the work that you've made, the career that you've had, is there a piece of advice that you've received that significantly influenced your work, or a piece of advice that you want to give anybody listening?
I mean, this is just like an ongoing... It just speaks to what you were just talking about, actually, about sort of whether our art is only good, whether it's validated by buildings, and actually whether we're only an artist when we're being platformed or celebrated. And I think, this is not from a specific person, but rather a conversation I've just been having for a really long time. But I think it's that, which is disturbing the status quo is uncomfortable. And I think if your work is designed to provoke or challenge or dismantle, that is not comfortable. And if you are lucky enough to be able to make that work, it's a question about commercial success versus great fucking stories. I will always pick a great fucking story, but I think, you know, work that is challenging will not always be comfortable to people on the other side, and therefore we cannot go, well, art is meaningful or validated because it gets brilliant reviews or accolades. And the second was actually about the kind of burden of feeling like I had to represent my community. We're not a monolith. There is such a diversity of experience and perspective amongst South Asians. And I think we will get closer to recognising and celebrating that diversity if we don't take on the responsibility of representing all of us. And that, again, was incredibly empowering for me, because I think I've made a more concert effort to platform and want to work with South Asian artists and talk about us. So that was really important for me, I think, both those schools of thought.
Stunning. Majisola.
I think I'm going to pay respect to a director I worked with back in the 90s called Denise Wong, who used to shout at us in Black Mind Theatre Company, which was the only black physical theatre company of its day. And she'd shout, "It's life and death! It's life and death!" as we were improvising. And, it was unsettling. And it was tough. But I think I still have that voice ringing in my ears, that the sense of, what is the most, what have you got to speak about and make now? What's urgent to you? What's important to you? It doesn't matter if it's not important to anyone else. You can guarantee if it's important to you, it's going to be important to someone else. Just like, what are those big life and death questions, concerns? And it doesn't mean it's got to be serious or anything. It just means what's just really, really important to you, and just make it and commit to it in that kind of life and death kind of way. And on the other side of that, I suppose, is with that sense of urgency, also knowing that, inshallah, you'll have a long life, and that you don't necessarily have to think just about making everything amazing right now, that things can take a long time to develop. And we in Britain are in this, as Millie said, in this ridiculous industry that makes us, bash out a show in 4 weeks. And for most of the world, that's an absurd idea. So just taking time and letting a piece emerge when it needs to emerge, and just trusting in that, and that's definitely what I learned from making Oranges and Stones, because it was a 10-minute piece, and it took 10 years to find the right people and the right moment to make that piece of work, and then it's been touring 14 years. So that's the time it needed. It needed 24 years to get to now. And that's okay, but it doesn't stop being urgent. It's still life and death. But hopefully life is long.
Lovely. Thank you so much. And thank you both, Millie and Majisola. Thank you so much for a gorgeous, fruitful conversation. Stay tuned for next week's episode.
If you love this episode, then please do share it with your friends and maybe even leave a cheeky review.
And for more of Tell Them, don't forget to subscribe and follow us on our socials for episode drops.
Join us for episode 6, where we're going to be chatting with Rani Murthy and Kareem Khan.